It is Monday, December 2nd, 2013, and this is episode 45 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, I'm joined tonight by Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening, and I hope everybody in the U.S. at least had a good Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. And, you know, because of that, I think we're going to go easy on, well, ourselves and the listeners and only cover a few things, so... Anyhow, you know, Bob had the week off, so I didn't get really any new stuff out of him. But I did hear he may be on his way to India.
Well, and they need the help, is what I've heard.
Yeah. So what did you learn?
So our first topic of the evening is a little article that was on Silicon India. And keep in mind, before I get into this, that this was a bit of a research project put out by a company that does InfoSec secure code training, right? So they have a bit of a vested interest. But according to them, 99% of all Indian IT engineering programmers lack secure programming skills. So in essence, less than 1% of Indian IT students or Indian IT programmers have any skill or knowledge or interest in secure coding practices.
It seems kind of alarming. The one thing that would be interesting to know is how that compares to other countries, you know, kind of what I've seen. I wonder if the U.S. is all that much better, but it is alarming that and possibly indicative that I don't think generally we put a lot of emphasis on secure coding. It's all about getting it out the door and under budget.
Yep.
And, you know, look at healthcare.gov.
I try not to. It hurts my soul. My eyes well, burn.
Okay. How about take it for example?
Fair enough. So what this tells me is be careful who you outsource to.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Be careful how you write your contracts for outsourcing and understand what you're getting for that outsourcing, right? And if you're outsourcing to folks who have zero knowledge or interest or care of secure coding practices, you're likely to get an application back that has no secure coding practices. So if this is important to you, realize and remember, coders don't think security first. And that's something we all need to work on.
Yeah, it's a good point, especially, you know, obviously it's really important if you're looking at an application that's going to be sitting out on the internet. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I have in recent memory seen pretty significant and severe examples of data loss and really deep penetration resulting from badly coded websites. But I think... Sure. I think that the other thing is that a lot of people don't take into account is it's important even for internal applications. You know, I think if nothing else, hopefully people are starting to get the concept or get the vibe that we ought to be acting like the bad guys are in our network. I mean, we've been talking about the perimeter is dead since I got into InfoSec, I don't know how long ago.
And well, I don't like particularly that term because I think it's A, misleading, and B, the next step is, so rip out all your firewalls. And
I disagree
with that advice.
We did have that discussion, and I agree. I totally agree with that point. But I think the point is that if we totally rely on only legitimate people being on an internal network and hence we don't have to worry about protecting our internal or intranet web applications from, you know, malicious use.
Yeah.
It's probably increasingly dangerous prospect.
100% agree. And you know, my personal opinion is that you really probably can't stop the majority of malware attacks. Well, I take that back. You can't stop all malware attacks. You can probably stop the majority. You must assume that malware is going to get in and is present. So then it becomes a matter of how do you identify it quickly? How do you isolate it quickly and minimize damage? And, you know, I was talking to a startup vendor today, and for now I'm going to keep their name quiet. But their approach was interesting, that they instrument the endpoint heavily and gather as much as they can about the actions of the endpoint in terms of execution of code, registry writes, file writes, you know, memory activity, everything they can, immediately, as quick as they can, offload it to a centralized server and just store all this information. The idea being that once something gets compromised, you have, in essence, a full data dump of everything that box has been doing up to the point where that compromise occurs. And still after that compromise occurs, assuming you can now still trust that information, right? They're pretty small. I don't think malware is going after them yet to shut them down or to, you know, kind of feed bad data into their feed. But eventually that'll happen, right? Eventually you can, you know, once a box is popped and it has a loader on it, you know, it's really tough to ever trust that box again or trust what you're getting off it. But it's interesting because it's a really neat tool for understanding the initial compromise and all sorts of weird behavior and where and how it came from. And I could see this as a very useful tool if you've got this on your devices, especially pairing it with network-based monitoring, right? With this assumption that, yeah, we're going to do everything we can to have multi-layer defenses. We're going to do everything we can to defend our network. But at the same time, we're instrumenting with the understanding that we are going to get popped. We need to find those quickly and shut them down quickly and understand what they did, which I think is a fairly rational way to go about it.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I'll tell you an interesting thing. We talk a lot about malware, but, you know, I've seen some recent cases where there's been some significant compromises using no malware at all. You know,
yeah.
You kind of just using tools that are native on the operating system. And those are a little more tricky because, you know, especially once you compromise a legitimate account through some mechanism, either brute force password guessing or something like that, you know, it becomes a little more difficult to tell because a lot of times it doesn't look anomalous. And for example, you know, you may want to, if you don't use, as an example, PSExec from sysinternals as a, you know, as something that you use as part of your normal system management, you may want to, you know, turn on your internal IPS sensors or IDS sensors to look for evidence of PSExec being run, because that's, you know, I've seen that happen. Mm-hmm. And it's not malware based, and you know you're not actually seeing what I would call a normal method of compromise, you know. And so
right.
you're seeing a bad person using normal admin tools in an inappropriate way. So
yeah, and you know it's funny, I've been talking to a lot of vendors lately. Some good, some not so good. And one thing I will say, and I think I said this on another show, is that if your sales pitch in any way includes, and we would have stopped Snowden, you know, no, but, you know, it was very much in line with that idea of we're going to watch and baseline normal behavior. And when normal behavior is deviated, like an admin logging in at 3 a.m. when they only usually log in at, you know, 8 a.m., we can trigger on that, right?
Yep.
Which is interesting. The problem, and keep in mind, you can always poke a hole in anything. That doesn't mean it's not a valid tool. But one of the things that always drives the SEs crazy when I put this out, and it's just me being mean, is what if you're already compromised when I'm baselining? Now I've just baselined in the compromise.
That's a good question.
They hate that. But keep in mind, that is a pocket case. That's a one percentile case, you know, and it's just me playing stump the chomp, but I really shouldn't do that because I've been on the other end of that so many times. But it's just, you know, sometimes fun. But it is one of those things, if you have to understand the technology you're working with, and if you're working with a technology that baselines normal behavior, you got to make sure your behavior is normal to baseline it.
Yeah,
I know this has gone massively off topic, but
boy, I'm not even sure how we ended up there, but that's good discussion.
Yeah.
So Well, the next story we have comes from Network World, and the title is Five Styles of Advanced Threat Defense Can Protect Enterprise from Targeted Attacks. And this was basically summarizing a report from Gartner. And Gartner put out this report that was basically titled that same thing. And I think you sent this to me, in fact, and I thought it was pretty cool. And it's really interesting because obviously it's Gartner, right? So they're kind of enamored with technology, but I thought their recommendations are interesting in that they largely are kind of retrospective monitoring kinds of things rather than, you know, blinky new protection crap.
Yeah.
So the first, you know, their first style of advanced threat defense is baselining network traffic, which you just mentioned.
Right. We just talked about it.
Yep. And you know, that's an important thing, right? And I think it goes beyond baselining, and obviously the reason you baseline is so that you can start looking for anomalies. And, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff people are doing with monitoring DNS, you know, DNS lookups and whatnot to spot, things, you know, DGA malware and all kinds of stuff like that. So there's a lot of interesting developments there that aren't hard to find. I know SANS, the Internet Storm Center guys, talk a lot about monitoring DNS. The second style they had is network forensics, and so that basically is essentially capturing all of your network traffic and storing it, and then having the ability to at some point in the future go back and mine it for for analysis after an attack. I would view it kind of like, oh boy, what's a good example? You know, I'm thinking about the dash cams, the Russian drivers drive around, yeah, with, you know, where it's constantly overwriting. It only keeps a couple of hours. Maybe a black box on an airplane is a better analogy. You know, it's not stored indefinitely.
Well, it really depends on how much you want to invest in hard drives too, right?
And sure,
you know, how far back you want to go. But I agree with both of you so far. You know, being able to reconstruct what happened and why, it's one of the biggest challenges we have with malware emergency response and malware remediation is not having instrumentation in place ahead of time to understand what happened. And you really can't trust the box anymore once it's been popped. So yeah, I agree with that.
Next is payload analysis. And so I think this one's probably more intuitive, and it is kind of in line with the blinky box. But again, it's not generally, at least yet, a protective measure. This is more of the FireEye style of model, where it's, you know, it's watching stuff go by, and then at some point in the future, it's going to say, "Oh, that was bad."
Yeah.
And you know, hopefully you have the ability to go back and say, well, you know, that file was consumed by these different endpoints and whatnot.
Yeah, and you can. And, you know, I'm most familiar with FireEye, and they have all those sorts of, you know, kind of correlations of, especially if it came in via web link, who clicked on it and, you know, what kind of malware got downloaded. And this is kind of the new shiny that a lot of people are jumping all over. And it is somewhat effective. It is not a silver bullet. And a lot of people are sort of emulating FireEye's model here. I know that Check Point is doing it. Palo Alto is doing it. Trend Micro is doing it.
I think even SourceFire is doing it now.
Yeah, I've heard some tell of that. So it's an interesting technique. I don't know how long this will be incredibly valid. I do like it. I'm not, because it doesn't utilize signatures. It doesn't utilize, having to have seen it someplace else before. It's modeling behavior, which is a good thing. But now it's sort of where, you know, whatever the Gartner cycle is, we're past the hype cycle and we're into widespread deployment, which means that the bad guys are probably going to start to adapt to this pretty soon. That doesn't mean it's not valid, but I bet that the malware is going to get more evasive against these. And, you know, if you talk to the vendors, they're like, oh yeah, we know all about that. We'll watch for that. We'll build in anti-evasive technology, and they will. But it, you know, it starts to become an arms race pretty quickly.
It definitely does. I know there's there's quite a number of, you know, anti-FireEye techniques. Like, I mean, something as basic as putting a counter in and, you know, and, yeah, and not executing, or some of them are tied to looking for keyboard input. And so I think there, as you defined it pretty well, it's an arms race. And I think that the really clever malware authors out there are already looking at it. And I've actually heard some talk about some malware authors have learned how to identify companies that use FireEye in particular.
Sure.
By actually sending them kind of lame payloads that give off tells, right? So it will it will actually go and download something from a site. The actual FireEye instance will go download something. And so if I send a phishing email or an email with an attachment, I can see if FireEye, I can potentially look for evidence that FireEye is processing it, and then that might guide what I do next.
Interesting. Well, there are ways to configure FireEye to make it very quiet that can limit your analysis to a certain extent. That is interesting. It makes sense.
Yeah.
The other problem that I'm seeing in general with these sandboxes, and I think this will get fixed, is in general, to my knowledge, you cannot build your own sandbox image yet. You're stuck with their image. So it may not have your versions of your software. It may not have, you know, I foresee that getting fixed soon, right? Where you can actually build and upload your own image in these sorts of tools. But anyway, it is one area that I'm seeing a ton of activity in. I think it is a useful area. Just understand the caveats.
Hey, you know, there's an idea for all you product managers listening out there. You know, the ability to think FireEye, with the ability to, you know, load a VMDK with your own image.
That's true. And if you'd like to hire Jerry and I as product consultants, very reasonable rates.
There you go.
If any VCs want to pick us up as, you know, consultants of who to invest in, we have very expensive rates.
Very, very expensive. Highly expensive. But well worth it. I mean, we've got good stories. So, The fourth and next style of advanced threat defense, according to Gartner, is endpoint behavior analysis. So whereas the payload analysis is more assumed to be a network concept, this is more specific to the endpoint. And kind of like, boy, I'm trying to think of, who do they reference here? So they reference like Mantech and Cyvera and Digital DNA and that sort of stuff.
You know, they mix a couple of different techniques here, right? So endpoint behavior analysis to me says watch for malicious activity as defined by the vendor and stop it. Yeah. Well, they're also throwing into here all the guys who are doing kind of micro kernels and micro VMs.
Yeah, so like the Bromiums and the Ansys. Yeah,
exactly. And these guys are basically standing up micro VMs that are made to be very disposable and are instances of individual applications. And if they get popped, you just, you know, blow it away and start it again. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, the intention of those ones is not to detect, but just to outright protect,
just mitigate it.
Right?
Yeah, just you don't care because it's not lasting. It could last, you know, an hour. So it's interesting that they mix those together. I wouldn't necessarily say that they are the same technique. One is micro virtualization. The other thing they're not putting in here is VDI, complete virtual desktops.
Yeah.
Which is another one. But
yeah, I mean, they should be throwing Citrix in there, right?
Yeah, amongst others. So it's interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know, who knows what the motivations are for which vendors get included in which categories?
Well, yeah, Gartner is a little pay to play. They try, but I'm a little cynical on their thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't disagree, though. It's a valid technique. It's just interesting how they lump things together here.
Agreed. The next style here is endpoint forensics. And so this is the ability again to retrospectively figure out what went wrong right. on a system. So this is your end case and, you know, very traditional forensics type things. But there are some interesting new capabilities like remote forensics, which are pretty cool. I've actually seen that being deployed, like with the Mandiant
yeah.
technology, which is pretty neat. Obviously, they have their own limitations, but you know, if you're a big global company or whatnot, it gives you some capabilities. And I can tell you, you know, that especially with workstations and servers to some extent, you know, things can fail in such amazing ways that, you know, it is, if you have the capability, it is very much worthwhile to do endpoint forensics.
Yeah, it's interesting that they actually throw in here the company I was talking about earlier, which, since it's in here, I'll just go ahead and say it's Carbon Black, which is the one that I was talking about earlier that takes that forensic snapshot of all the activity going on the device. But then Gartner also throws in Bit9, which, yes, it does have forensic capabilities, but that's not its primary role. Its primary roles are whitelister.
Right.
Now, a lot of people use it for the forensic capabilities, and it does a really good job of that. But again,
it's a bit of a stretch.
It is. And I think whitelisting is, in and of itself, its own category of a useful defensive technique. And so I'm not sure why they threw Bit9 into this particular one. Though it does have that capability, it's not what I would deem the primary use case of that tool.
Yeah, speaking of whitelisting, it's really interesting that none of the five techniques here are, you know, more the traditional AV or even whitelisting.
Yeah, and I agree traditional AV shouldn't be here, but I don't agree that whitelisting is not here. Whitelisting, I think, is a valid technique.
Yeah, I agree with you.
But yeah, AV is just...
I'm done with AV.
Put a fork in it.
So done with it. But you know what?
You still need it.
But you still need it. I mean, because everybody expects you to have it, but there are some legitimate uses.
Oh yeah, it blocks. You know, it's. You know, I was having this discussion with somebody the other day, and I said, "Well, you're not going to get rid of the AV, right? Because it's like having a tank. You know, you build armor to defend against a certain caliber of weapon, and then new calibers of weapons come out, and you add armor or change armor to deal with that caliber weapon, but you don't want to ignore the earlier calibers. You still got to make sure you defend against those, because if we got rid of AV, I assure you the bad guys would just go back to really simple attacks that, you know, AV is stopping right now, that these other guys aren't looking at because AV is catching them.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think I may have said it really early on in an early episode, but One of the values of AV is potentially non-obvious, and I think this kind of may inform you as to which vendor you might want to associate with, and that's that. In my experience, one of the major values of AV is helping to stop the propagation of an attack or a malware outbreak that's underway, and so obviously in many scenarios, AV is going to fail you miserably. It's just not going to detect it, you know. But if you do have an infection underway and you have a good relationship with your vendor and they are able to turn around signatures, you know, relatively fast, it can be an effective protective measure to your environment. It's a good way to quickly propagate out the ability to stop, you know, a particular thing that you have detected and worked with your provider. Now, you know, obviously there's lots of caveats to that, you know, there's polymorphism and all that, blah, 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 right? But, you know, in general, if you, and I've seen this firsthand on a number of occasions, and it does work, right? And sometimes, obviously, it doesn't work, right? But I've seen it work more often than not. Is it worth the premium that we pay? I don't know. But, you know, that's a different discussion.
But for really large enterprises, they almost have no choice. It's a
we don't,
you know, due Absolutely. Diligence sort of thing, right? You know, you've got to show that you did everything you could.
Absolutely. But, you know, I think the thing you said earlier is spot on. You know, it's It's like walking the high wire without a net, you know, and especially if something bad happens and you don't have AV, you are going to look like a dumbass.
Yeah.
Even if AV wouldn't have stopped it.
Right.
You're still going to look like a dumbass.
Is that but true?
So, yeah, so that was that article. The next article we have, and the final article, is from InfoWorld, and the title is Malware, the War Without End. And that's definitely what it feels like. It's kind of a wandering and meandering article, and I know that you love this because there's all kinds of great quotes from vendors who, you know, who are selling the thing that they're talking about. But I thought it was interesting. You know, one of there's a couple of key things that really resonated with me. You know, number one was that unlike in times gone by, at the moment we exist right now, we don't have major malware outbreaks that we don't have effective protections against. You know, so clearly there are every day there's malware that's not being detected by AV, but you know, it's not that AV doesn't have the capability to detect it. It's that, you know, it just doesn't happen to have that detection built in at the moment. And so, you know, they kind of go through right now, we've got signature AV, we got behavioral monitoring, we got blacklisting and whitelisting. And, you know, the combination of those are generally pretty effective for most kinds of malware as it exists today. And obviously that could change. Another point in the article is that there is some progress on the application front. And I thought this was an interesting thing for me. It made me feel a little better about the world. But, you know, I think, what was the quote? Something like, the drop in the number of vulnerabilities in Microsoft Office is an example. I think it was 126 in Office 2007 and 6 in Office 2010. And, you know, time could go on and next week we could discover 50 in 2010. Who knows, right? But I think the point is that some of the mainstream software vendors are getting on the bandwagon. They're starting to figure it out. Microsoft is definitely among them. I know even Adobe, as much as we like to have fun with them, right? Even they, from a Flash and PDF reader perspective, are getting a lot better. Java is Java. Java will always be Java, but it's a great remote access tool. That's all I can tell you.
Well, it loads a fine ass.com toolbar.
It does.
You know, my thought on this is that we could probably have really, really secure software, but it would probably cost us 10 times as much as it does today. And that is the challenge.
Yep.
You know, Microsoft could probably make an incredibly secure operating system if they really wanted to, but they would release a new operating system every, you know, 10 to 15 years, and it would cost $1,000 a box, at least.
Yeah, and nobody would want it, right? I mean, yeah. I don't think that's a big differentiator. I think the market has spoken there.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my point. You hit it spot on. The market basically has said, yes, we care about security, but not at the expense of all these other things.
Exactly.
And this is the challenge. This is the challenge.
So there was another great quote in here that I just loved, and I don't remember who said it, but they basically said they see two different types of malware threats. There's APTs and AFTs. You know, obviously, we all know what APTs are, but the AFTs are another freaking Trojan, which I thought was really, really quite funny.
Yes. That's,
you know, and the point there is that there is just an absolute proliferation of Trojans. And in fact, that's about all we see these days. You know, we don't see much. And yeah, I mean, obviously there's always exceptions, right? But we don't see the big mass propagating worms and viruses and things like that. They're all Trojans these days. Mm-hmm. You know, they almost all of them connect back to a botnet. They allow remote access. They do some useful specific thing. And you know, the other point is that the underground economy, right, is mechanizing this stuff, and down to the point where a lot of these Trojans are being delivered by watering hole style attacks, and some of these exploit kits are sophisticated to the point where everybody that goes and downloads it gets a custom packaged instance. It's not, you know, the same Trojan. There's really nothing to latch on to.
Which goes back to the whole why AV is struggling so badly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's custom, you know, hash every time sort of thing.
Right.
And for the record, that quote came from Roger Thompson, chief security researcher at ICSA Labs.
Yes. And I thought that was great.
Yes.
I loved it.
And I just want to be fair and give him his...
Thank you.
Yep.
I appreciate that. I couldn't get back there on my iPad quick enough, so... Anyhow. Well,
that's why when we record, I'm on a dual monitored computer with about 18 things up, and I can, you know, distract myself, and my ADD is quite satiated. In fact, I'm doing Cyber Monday shopping as we speak.
Yes.
What size do you wear again?
Small. Right. But you know, there's some other points in there about how, you know, again, going back to what I would call the industrialization of malware, and how it's really being kind of broken up into an assembly line style model where you've got different people writing droppers and different people writing the exploit kit and different people, you know, writing the componentry for the command and control, and you know, and they're all, it's modular now, and you know, it's actually quite an industry.
So next we're going to see a 60 Minutes expose on the, you know, coding sweatshops in India of the guys writing all the malware droppers and terrible conditions.
You know, I wonder if you were to reverse engineer some of these, if you'd find, you know, the please help me get me out of this hellhole.
You know, you might be onto something.
Anyway, the next point in the article was the new frontiers for malware appear to be Windows XP and Android. And, you know, Android is probably self-evident. If you look at any of the charts about the growth of malware on Android, it's really startling. The, you know, it's like hundreds or thousands of percent year-on-year growth. And you know, it's kind of beyond exponential growth that we're seeing there. And, you know, it's ironic because a lot of people are in total denial about the vulnerability and security, particularly Android, you know, and, yep. And it's, I think it's kind of become like the new religious war. You know, it's reminds me so much of the old Mac versus Windows of, you know, of the 90s. And here we are, iOS and Android. They seem to be like taking the same thing, although it's kind of a interesting role reversal now that the Android people, who I equate with PCs, are in total denial that they got a problem.
Yeah. And there's also dozens of different versions of Android out there. And it's going to be really tough. You know, the one thing Apple's got going for it is their users are really good about upgrading and really good about being on the same OS. And so if there ever were a major issue to come out for Apple, I think Apple's in a better spot to get their users to patch quickly. Android, I don't know.
Well, part of the problem, and there's been a lot of debate and discussion about this, but the main problems with Android are that so much is left up to the carrier and to the handset manufacturers.
Well, we're back to the days of how Windows came about, right? And they had to have this plug-in architecture for drivers and this open architecture.
Point.
And it's one of the reasons why Windows struggled so much to be able to add new sort of technologies, is they needed to be backwards compatible. And, you know, Apple had the joy of controlling the hardware. Now, there's different market ramifications when you do this. And so we're seeing the same thing today. Same exact model play out. So it will be interesting.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, by the way, I'm not saying that the iOS is way more secure. All I'm saying is that it apparently is either not as profitable or whatever up to create malware for iOS. And I guess if you're running a jailbroken iOS device, it's a lot more similar to Android. But you know, if you're not, it's a relatively good platform.
Yeah, and I think especially when you look in developing parts of the world, Android is much more established. And I think Android's probably a better option for lots of reasons for the bad guys to go after.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I'm not going to pass any judgment on the inherent security or insecurity of either. I do think Apple, in their closed ecosystem, which drives people crazy, myself included, though I do own an iPhone, has a better shot at controlling it. You know, as long as they are being smart, though we're starting to hear some stories of things slipping through, you know, the Apple store that is malicious. So I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, I think we're going to hear of, I would say, a few really bad ones versus, you know, mass pandemonium that seems to be happening on the Android side. So, you know, we'll see. Their point on XP is that, you know, it's fallen off the cliff April 8th, 2015.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of sympathy if you're running XP. You're just asking for pain.
But, you know, I hear that a lot, and I agree. But, you know, I also read an article, and I should have kept it, but I read a lot of crap during the week, and, you know, a lot of it doesn't stick with me. But anyway, one of the things I read was about how, you know, the security on the internet's kind of a communal thing, right? So if your insecurity impacts me, right? The fact that you choose to run XP and I don't impacts me because your computer is now, you know, DDoSing the crap out of me or sending me spam or whatever, you know, that sort of thing.
It takes a village, Jerry.
Yeah, I know.
Well, all the more reason, right? You know, And I think what you're going to see is ISPs getting more aggressive about shutting down people who are, you know, spamming or DDoSing or whatever. You know, at least if it's a home user environment, right? In a corporate environment, well, you know, hopefully that corporation's smart enough to know about these things. But nonetheless, I still stand by, you're asking for trouble if you're running XP. Get off XP, right? That's the only answer to that.
Right now, get off.
You know, it's the only valid response to, you know, XP's getting owned. There's no other option other than upgrade. And I get it. It's painful. It hurts. But if you want to be secure, that's the price. And I shouldn't say secure like it's a black white thing. If you want to be more secure,
good point. That's a good point. I think the concern is that. This was brought up a couple of months back, right? That all of these exploit writers have been sitting on, you know, Windows XP exploits, and come May 2014, it's just going to be mass chaos because they're going to be dropping these things left and right.
Yep.
And we'll still have, you know, something like, you know, tens of millions of users running XP, and they're just going to be totally hosed.
Well, I guess it depends on, you know, who these users are and what's on their box and whether or not they care.
Yeah.
You know, and are we at a point where boxes are, you know, those people find these things disposable and they go to Best Buy and buy a $500 PC and be done with it?
That does seem to be the thing now, right?
You know,
my computer's running slow. Throw it in the trash.
You know, this is one thing I do like about the advent of app stores that started on phones and are now migrating to operating systems, is that the auto patching is a wonderful thing for home users.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that will help over time.
And by the way, don't tell anybody, but there's this cool thing called PSI made by Secunia that I think it's the personal software inspector or something like that. It will automatically update your software.
Shocking.
I know. anyway, I digress. And then I think that the last point they had was that the you know, the opportunities for malware seem to be kind of endless, because it's really limited only by the creativity of the malware authors and the gullibility of the victims. And, you know, the stupid, something is freaking stupid, and I'm just going to vent for a second, right? It's freaking stupid as the tech support scam. How can people fall for this?
You know, it was funny, off topic but related. I was reading something or watching something the other day. It was talking about how the mind ages. And for whatever reason, the way our minds age, one of the first faculties that start to go is those that have to do with processing anything financial, which is why a lot of seniors are more likely to fall for some sort of scam financially. For whatever reason, you know, as our brains age, the first area that starts to, you know, show dementia or lack of good cognitive process are those things around finances. So I think that probably has something to do with it, which tells me that once you're over the age of 60, we should confiscate all IT equipment.
Back to pen and paper with you.
No, but you know, that is part of it, right? And the bad guys, you know, we've had con men since people walked on, you know, started walking on this earth. And whatever way you choose to believe that began, con men showed up shortly thereafter. And they're very good at finding ways to exploit people. And whether that's being done via a computer or something else doesn't really matter. It's still a con, and it's still exploiting, you know, people's weaknesses, which don't change.
Yeah, I guess thinking about this in the context of a business setting, it bothers me that I see this happening, and I do see it happening, that, you know, somebody will call up and say, hey, I'm with Microsoft, or usually it's something dumb like, hey, I'm with Windows support, or I'm with the help desk. And then at the end, they're like, so I need your credit card number. You know, when's the last time you had to pay for your company's help desk support?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know.
You're right. I mean, I think part of it too is the computer is still this mythical black box of magic, right? And
touche.
Run with fairy dust and unicorn blood, and, you know, people are afraid of it. I have a good friend who's afraid to push buttons because she doesn't know what it's going to do. And she's a very intelligent person. But there's this intimidation and fear when it comes to computers for a lot of people. And that's easy to exploit. And especially, in a non-corporate environment. In a corporate environment, that's really bad. People would say, well, go for, you know, user education, blah, blah, blah. I don't know that really helps. You can try. I'm not a big fan. I didn't mean to interrupt you mid-rant there. Feel free to continue ranting.
I think you're on a good point. And ultimately, we do have to, I guess I have to come to terms with the fact that people are going to fall for dumb stuff. And
you're just so unreasonable, Jerry.
I know, I am. And
your expectations of people are just way too high.
And we have to make our environments resilient to that and accommodate for that. You know,
absolutely, 100% agree.
I don't think it is reasonable anymore for us to set as a baseline assumption that people's behavior are a reasonable part of your control set.
I think that's a great point. And I think it's one that frustrates people, but I think you're 100% correct. And this is why I'm going to buy a cabin in Montana and write a manifesto.
But by the way, I think I mentioned it before. I finished the book called Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. It was fantastic. It's about... It's basically about behavioral economics and about how people are obviously irrational. And then I'm into the second book, about halfway done with the second book, about the upside of irrationality. And, you know, it's totally nothing about security, But at the same time, I see all of the motivations of bad security practices being represented. So
nice. You know,
I think it's a great book for security. Or great, there's three books in the set. They're great books for security people to read, because I think it really sheds some light onto the behavioral aspects of security. So,
and in my quest to continue to try to find a way to monetize this show, you know, there's a way that you can set up an affiliate program and have links to all these books you recommend and make like 2 cents off of every sale.
Hey, we could go and split a 99 cent value meal at McDonald's.
That's true. At least I'm very honest in my... And for the record, we have completely failed thus far to monetize in any way. But we're going to keep trying.
Yes, this podcast costs me quite a lot of money. Let's just say that. But I do it because I love it.
It's for the people. He's doing it for the children.
Yes, I enjoy talking about this. I hope this is helping people, nothing else, you know, while they're on the treadmill or whatever. So anyhow.
Yeah, in all seriousness, yes. I do hope that our ramblings are useful. At least helping spur thought.
Absolutely. So shifting gears a little bit, we did want to talk about the art and science of picking consultants, especially pen testers. And I know, given the holidays and, you know, you had crazy stuff going on, I had crazy stuff going on, I don't think we had a lot of time to assemble many coherent thoughts. But maybe next time we can really dig into it. But did you want to kind of kick it off a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And full disclosure, I do work for a company that sells pen testing. And I have in the past talked about this and people misunderstood and got really angry at me. So hopefully I will repeat that problem. But you know, the one thing that I always like to say about pen testing is, if you're doing a pen test once a year and you think you're secure, you're probably not. And because there's so many caveats around what a pen test is actually doing. They're incredibly sexy, they're fun. I used to do pen tests. You know, I work with people now who do pen tests. I sell pen tests. But it really depends on your goal of what you're trying to achieve. And if you're doing a, you know, kind of the old school pen test stuff, here's the magic file you have to get to. The pen testers will find a way to get there, most likely, and they will succeed. And they will tell you how. But that doesn't mean you're secure or that you've closed all the holes. Because most likely, if that's the type of pen test you're setting up, that pen tester is going to find a way to achieve that goal and not explore other options. And there may be many other ways that the bad guys could come in. And, you know, usually there's a whole bunch of artificial constraints put around the pen tester. And, you know, it is not the same thing as if the bad guys are actively coming after your company at all. And I think we need to understand that and know that. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not very useful tools, but they have to be used in the right context. And, you know, the really short version of this is what I prefer is full-on vulnerability assessments, which look for multiple vulnerabilities and find as many as can be found, and full on ongoing process, you know, analysis, not just throwing technology in at it, but what are we doing as a process and a procedure in an organization? What are our processes like to build security into the infrastructure and maintain security in the infrastructure? Because the other problem with the pen test and even a vulnerability assessment is you may remediate everything they find, and as soon as you change something, you potentially have it open up a new attack surface that no longer is valid, right? So if you're doing this once a year and just thinking you're good, I beg to differ. I would say that you have a point in time snapshot of a security, you know, infrastructure view that is very dynamic and highly fluid. And, you know, this is something that I think is not well embraced yet by medium and small business. I think large business get this, but I don't think medium business get this, especially with the PCI mandate of getting a pen test or vulnerability assessment done once a year and they think they're good. They're valid. They're useful. Don't get me wrong, but they can also come with a false sense of security. And hopefully I didn't just get myself fired by this whole rant.
But basically, I think what you're saying is there's got to be more to it than just hiring a pen test to go, hey, try hacking into my website and tell me how you got in, and then I'll go fix it. You need to really think about the context of how that's being done.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are time and place. It's a wonderful tool if you're trying to justify spend. And, you know, because CEOs get this, CIOs get this, the board gets this, right? They understand.
Somebody broke in. They broke in.
Right. And they got our payroll file, right? That is a visceral gut reaction that can get people to wake up to a problem. Of the traditional penetration test style. You know, quick side funny story is this was many years back, I was giving a keynote talk at a conference that was being hosted by a partner of the company I was working with. And I started down this topic and I had slides. And I was intentionally being bombastic and I was intentionally being shocking, right? And I was intentionally, you know, start trying to throw controversial things at the audience and then bring it back to reality. And I started with the concept of pen tests are worthless. And then went into my entire discussion as to why. And, you know, the problem was the local regional VP for that partner only saw my first slide and stormed out of the room. And blew up the phone lines of the executives of the company I was working at the time. The rest of her team stayed in the room and agreed completely with my point because it was basically saying to them, sell more services, not less. And oh my God, it was a shitstorm, pardon my French. So I'm a little gun shy now when I talk about this. So don't misunderstand. You know, pen tests are valuable, but they come with caveats and they're not a magic push button to make you secure.
Well, and I think to your point, and you know, I've got a lot of strong feelings, and you know, I do also work for a company that does pen tests. So I share a lot of your points, and it is only a point in time. However, it's a really great opportunity to test the effectiveness of some of your other processes. And so, you know, if you contrast it with like internal audit in, you know, business controls types of things where you really they're going in and they're looking to see, you know, did you have a change ticket to do this? And did you apply that patch? They're really not looking at, you know, can this server be penetrated? Can't, you know, and so I think it's not a standalone thing. It has to be put in the context of a larger governance program, but if it's done right, and obviously it has to be kind of commensurate with the, you know, whatever the risk of your, you know, your environment is, I think it's a great thing. And obviously you need to pick a good team that, you know, that isn't going to just find the first thing and then call it a day and say, hey, you know, here we you know, mission accomplished. Here's our thing. Here's our bill. And, you know, that's not all that useful because your point, and I think it's really important to understand is that can give you a false sense of security. If you know, if they say, hey, you know, we got in, here's how we got in. We found this SQLI, you know, vulnerability that let us drop a web shell and then we were able to get around, and so you close that and say, oh hey, you know, we had a pen test, we remediated their findings and we're good, which you may be good, you may not be good. That's really important. It's a good point. Excellent point.
No, I think you brought up a great point too, that if you can use this as a red teaming exercise, that's incredibly valuable. You know, checking your incident response, checking your ability to detect, you know, good pen testing can even do, you know, code an O-day and do a malware simulation against you. You know, so you really get what you pay for, I think. And, you know, going back to how do you choose one, I would say definitely go with an experienced tester, an experienced testing company who has a well-defined methodology, has really solid deliverables, understands the business impact of these items they're finding, not just some really, you know, sharp gray hats who run some tools. that is no longer really valid and useful to a business. That's folks who have some skills but don't know necessarily how to put it in context of the business.
The Metasploit monkeys.
Yeah, you know, and you know, they're out there, right? So it's really tough to know what a pen test from company A versus a pen test from company B means. It can mean completely different things. You know, I'd recommend take a look at their sample deliverables, take a look at their methodologies, talk to their practice managers, you know, make sure that they have some infrastructure and methodology built up around these tests that are valid.
So do you often see people asking for sample reports? Because I think that's a great idea.
I'm a little gun shy about talking about my day job here, but you know, the short answer is yes. But also, who I work for considers our deliverables somewhat intellectual property.
Okay.
So we're not very free with just giving them out.
Yeah, I get it.
But we do have sanitized deliverables that we use, and we, you know, can share with customers or potential customers. But we don't want to give away some of our secret sauce, so we don't, you know, just post them willy-nilly. I think whenever I'm talking about these sorts of tests with a customer, I try to really explore, why are you doing this? What is your goal? What is your intent here? What is it you're trying to get out of these tests? And what is going to make the decision for you? Are you deciding this based off of who's got the cheapest price? You know, that sort of thing, so that we can start comparing apples to apples and they can make a good decision. Because in general, the company I work for is really good, but we're not the cheapest. But we're very thorough and excellent skills. So, you know, we've got to understand what the customer's going after.
Get what you pay for.
Yeah. So, and there are other great vendors out there too, right? You know, the company I work for is not the only one out there, but I'd say we're probably in the top five in the U.S. for what we do. It's just sometimes tough to compete when you've got, you know, like you say, the Metasploit monkeys down the street doing it for a quarter of our price.
Reminds me of photography. You know, I know there's a lot of people who are in, you know, aspiring professional photographers, and the proliferation of SLR cameras has basically, you know, just dropped the dropped any pricing out of the photography market. It's pretty interesting.
Cost entry is so low. Then it really comes down to who really has the talent.
Exactly.
Which makes it hard. So anyway, hey, at the end of the day, maybe all you need is some Metasploit monkeys. I don't know. You know, that could be what you need, but understand what you're getting, right? You know, and how much it's going to cost you.
So what about the paradox of pen testing a live environment versus a test environment?
Yeah, this is a tough one. What I typically say is, all right, let me back this up. Companies hate the test against production. I get it. They're worried about the pen test causing an outage. My response to that, though it's very rarely accepted, is if the pen test costs you an outage, then the bad guys could do it at will. Wouldn't you rather the good guys be the ones who do it in a coordinated fashion with you at a time of your choosing?
Yeah, exactly.
And be controlled.
That's my perspective, is that right. You can do, the pen testers can do it on your time, or the bad guys can do it on their time.
Yeah, and if something's that easy to knock over and is that fragile, you've got a problem. And the bad guys are going to find it, right? Especially, you know, assuming it's all externally facing. Internally facing depends. I think production is key. I think that it's very, very, very difficult to mirror production in QA, no matter what people say. It's typically different gear, you know, maybe different firmware, maybe different BIOSes, maybe who knows. So I recommend and I prefer to test against production, but I understand that's risky. And I think that is a value to that risk, like anything. And I think that's an individual company's decision to decide what they want to do. But I would recommend testing against production. What do you think?
I agree. I mean, totally agree. I'm, you know, I guess at my core, I'm kind of an IT guy before a security guy. And, you know, one of the things I love is that the whole Netflix chaos monkey model, you know, and it bothers me greatly to hear companies and organizations not want to do something really important like this in the live environment because they fear that it's going to cause problems. And, you know, look, you're going to get pen tested whether or not you like it, right? You can be, the pen test can be done by someone you pay or someone who's just going to come along and do it for you and not give you a report.
Yeah. 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 So it's, you know, this is a topic that could be debated at length, you know, especially if you start bringing business folks into the fold. Because as security folks, you know, we see it from one side. But, you know, when you start talking about business folks, it's kind of like we were talking about earlier. You know, if you get owned and you're not running AV, how are you going to look? If you cause your own outage with, you know, your own test, how are you going to look?
Can't argue with that point, right? That's a good point.
So I think it really just comes down to having a high level, and when I say high level, I mean from an executive ranks, involved to understand the risk reward and help make that call.
Yeah. Yep. And with everything, you know, it's going to be dependent on the organization. So, well, you know, despite limiting ourselves to two stories, or I guess three stories, we've still gone over an hour.
We are just chatty.
Yes. Well.
Sorry.
It's okay. I think it was a good discussion. I think we should probably cut it off, and we can continue the discussion next week. So with that, I think we'll call it a show. I appreciate everyone listening. I definitely encourage you, if you like the show, give us a rating on iTunes. Tell your friends about us. You can find the show at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find it on just about every fine podcasting venue out there. The show is on Twitter at DefensiveSec. Mr. Callett is on Twitter at Lurg, and he posts way more interesting stuff than I do. Mine is at MaliciousLink. I intend to work on that, by the way, but, well, you know. And also, if you have any ideas, feedback, criticism, whatever, just want to talk, you know, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. And with that, I wish you all a very pleasant week. Take care.